next, we'll get to less methodological, or at least slightly less methodological topics of MEG, the study of language and cognition. Like I've been saying, the face-lock evoke responses are the, let's say, primary therapy has been used and still used to study language and cognition with MEG. And as this course is on the psychologies of research at Jyväskylä, and also then my own research, I'm not going to talk about these evoked responses in any detail, except the examples that I've already shown. As this is such a commonly used measure, we give some possible reading if you're interested. So there are a couple of open access publications that you can freely download. So there's one by Harri and Salmelin. It's mostly about general MEG, methodology and MEG, but it also has both responses and evoked responses you applied in language studies, and lots of good references for further reading if you are interested. And then more like specialized, specific article by Martin et al. On space temporal convergence of semantic processing, reading and speech perception. So it covers both visual processing of words and then listening to speech. So that how is language processed? Especially the evoked responses views you can obtain. But my own research has focused on the, especially the activity measures on the auditory and induced activity. So I'll be talking more about these. So there's, I will also touch slightly upon the behavioral relevance of the MEG measures and phenomena. There's also a topic on how cognitive training can be applied to MEG studies. First of all, then about this one, let's say, fairly general notion on the auditory responses. So then actually this kind of responses and phenomena are very useful if you are interested in the, let's say, more natural tasks. The evoked responses and face-lock evoked responses are designed for experiments where you have very specific events. Normally, actually, play, let's say, one word time and you average for those. But what if you are interested in the more like continuous natural processing? This is an example on the really natural language processing, or at least naturalistic language processing, and perception and production both. So here, the subjects were first asked to produce speech when they were in MEG scanner, like segments of speech, tens of seconds at a time spontaneously. The speech was recorded and played later on back to them. And of course, there were some other stimulus categories. They produced individual syllables or listened to somebody else's speech. But with this kind of experiment, we can study natural language processing. And in this case, the effects of the linguistic content, whether it's speech or something else, or noise or syllables, speaking rate, because subjects were asked to speak the normal tempo or faster or slower. And then also the speech ownership. What if you are hearing somebody else's speech or your own speech, what happens? And this could be studied both, some of these for both the perception and production side. Well, the main result of this study was that we saw right hemisphere dominant effects in natural language perception and production in both, which is sort of a bit surprising. As for this evoked responses, normally there has been at least a slight left hemisphere dominance. As for these natural processes, these auditory continuous processes, the main effects were seen in the right hemisphere. For example, in the for linguistic content, so the production, either producing speech or syllables, or for the perception, listening to speech or just noise. Both cases, there were lots of right hemisphere activations. For the production, there was also things on the left hemisphere, like a bilateral motor contribution for the perception. We only saw things in the right hemisphere. So for the speaking rate, there was not this kind of right hemisphere dominance. Instead, the production, it was fairly bilateral. We see it. So the for the normal versus slow, so for it faster than slower rate, there was a more contribution of the motor components, the primary and second premotor cortex, for example. As for the perception, actually, what is so interesting is that actually there was more activity for the slow and fast both compared to normal. So then actually this listening to speech at normal tempo required the least, or elicited the least amount of neural activity. As for the speech ownership, when you actually were listening to somebody else's speech compared to your own speech, there's much more activity and only the right hemisphere. So this kind of descriptions using the posterior approach and continuous naturalistic data of language processing. And in this study, like I said, some of these phenomena could be combined across the perception production. So then actually many of these regions were seen both in the perception production side, especially these main components, both in the left temporal cortex and right temporal cortex, and then the right temporal parallel junction, which is here, the shared components also in purple. Actually, we didn't really see any regions would be activated uniquely for perception. They were all pretty much covered in the production network. For the production network, we did see, of course, then, let's say, motor contribution, which we're not seeing in the perception, but that was sort of the only unique. I think mostly the components were shared across the perception production. And interestingly, well, we did see some contribution in the classical language regions, for example, in the left and right temporal cortex, and then to a degree in the frontal cortices. But then actually, interestingly, this gave a quite complementary view that with the baseline pivot responses, typically there's lots of contribution in the primary sensory regions and the visual processing in the primary visual cortex, or this word like region in the fusiform gyrus, the left stream response. And then if you consider fMRI literature, you would have, of course, expected a bit more frontal contribution. But it's quite interesting that you get information with the oscillatory approach that was not evident in the other approaches, where they consider different imaging measures, like baseline responses, or then other neuroimaging modalities such as fMRI. Then actually then this induced activity can be applied also, well, it's not oscillatory activity, but I would call it induced rhythmic activity, can be applied to this kind of multi-view cognitive experimentation. So basically, it's actually a good measure to use for this kind of simultaneous evaluation of working memory, inhibition, image comparison in the elderly. This is an actually ongoing study. The experiment consisted of an encoding image, an image the subject had to keep in mind. At some point later, there's a distractor image that captured the subject attention. Later on, there was a third image presented. The task in here was to match this to the original encoding image to say whether these two match or whether they do not match. The response was asked, question mark. So there are actually lots of different stages. There's the basic encoding stage. There's something that happens at the distractor phase, something captures your attention. You have to inhibit the processing of this. And then there's the image comparison or target retrieval phase later on. So there are lots of neural processes, lots of cognitive processing that need to be followed. So, and what do we get in this kind of multi-view cognitive experimentations? Like I said, there are lots of different processing stages and you can look at, and we actually use different measures. Although I say that we didn't use both responses, we used them for the last stage, but for these earlier phases, we didn't really look at what happens directly. When after seeing the figure, we were seeing what happens when actually you are a bit later on, when you are in the first time window maintaining figure in mind. So not what happens when you see it, when you have to maintain the figure in memory, comparing that to the pre-phase image processing. And you can see that there's lots of high frequency neural activity in the prefrontal regions that increases. Also some other process in the low frequencies. But then second question is about this inhibitory stage. What happens after you have seen this kind of distract image? There are actually two types of distract images in this experiment. There was an easy distract, this kind of oval shape that doesn't really capture attention or get mixed with the face image. Or then there were other face images, not the one that you were supposed to encode, but other face images. And what happens after this kind of two different types of distractors? What we could see is that actually there's a difference actually in the posterior regions in the brain, paradoxical regions in the low frequencies. And then when you are actually matching the figures, you can use this evoked responses to see if there's a difference. Now, these are the same type of face stimuli, but if you compare the figures that match or do not match the encoded image, you can see here that there's increased activity in certain time windows for the matching versus non-matching figures. So I can actually get with using combining multiple neural phenomena and imaging measures and multiple stages of processing, get lots of information from a single experiment. And like I said, we of course want to understand whether this sort of means anything. Typically, many of the MEG experiments stop at the previous slide so that you can differentiate two, let's say, experimental conditions. So in this case, the working memory versus pre-working memory stage, easy versus difficult distractor, or matching versus non-matched target. They wanted to understand if these are, how relevant these are with respect to human behavior. In this case, we did so that we had like cognitive test battery for every subject, so we could measure their cognitive performance outside the MEG experiment using this CERAD test battery. And then in this case, we could see that these different components can be either positively or negatively correlated with the, let's say, cognitive profile of the subjects. So we can know that these neural modulations that we see during the experiment are really reflecting the individual level, the cognitive capabilities of the subjects. And in this same data set, we also had this kind of cognitive training element involved. So these subjects, they did the MEG task three times at the time point of 0, 6 months later, or 12 months later. And there was a difference that the subjects were divided into two groups. One group got only physical exercise training, the other one had physical exercise training plus cognitive training. And then you can compare if the two groups of subjects differ somehow. And actually what we saw is that they do differ in the neural processing for this inhibitory processing for the distractor phase. So that time point of 0, the groups are at the equal level. But as the training progresses, two types of training, the neural responses diverge. So that actually the cognitive training induces differences between the subject populations in the neural processing. So now I have given some highlights and examples of using oscillator-induced active in the study of language and cognitive processing and focusing on the research done at the U.S. University of Jyväskylä. So you could hopefully answer the questions of what are the main experimental differences in investigating oscillatory versus induced activity or oscillatory versus base-locked activity. What are the benefits of these different experimental approaches? And how can the relevance of the observed, let's say, neural modulation, regardless of the type of measure that you use, be examined in more detail?